Welcome to Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today's guest is Eduardo Perez. Eduardo, a former major leaguer, pretty good hitter in his day, and has been doing broadcasting in one form or another with ESPN since 2006. Baseball Tonight, College World Series, MLB games, all kinds of stuff. And a former colleague of mine and a friend of mine. And what a joy it is to catch up with him. One of my first times on campus in Bristol, he said, come, I'm taking you out to dinner. And there's like nowhere to eat near Bristol. He took me for Mongolian barbecue, which I mentioned to him on the podcast. And I'm forever grateful to that for that, because then I knew I had a place to eat in the future and an ally on staff. It could be intimidating with like big league ball players and stuff, and you're some hoser from Canada. So it was really cool. He's a very nice fellow, really smart baseball man. And this was a great conversation. Everything from the aftermath of Hurricane Maria to, heck, I mean, he's the son of Tony Perez. So growing up in that Reds clubhouse in like the mid-70s, when Ken Griffey Jr. was six, and so was he, and Pete Rose Jr., and an amazing collection of people in that tunnel. And he tells great stories about that, too. I think you'll really dig this podcast. It's a lot of fun. Let us discuss this week's sponsor, friends, and that is our old friends at SeatGeek. Yes, you know SeatGeek. It's the best place to buy or sell tickets to anything you could possibly imagine, sporting events, concerts, what have you. I have used SeatGeek for concerts, and I have used SeatGeek for baseball and hockey and lots of other events, and they are great. Color-coded map shows you where the best deal in the ballpark and or arena might be. Color-coded, really easy to use, and fantastic. I am a big, big fan of SeatGeek. I'm also a big fan of deals. And how about this? If you download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code Jonah today, you'll get $20 off of your first purchase. That's right. Just download the SeatGeek app, enter the promo code Jonah, and once you have completed your first purchase, you'll get $20 off instantly just by entering the promo code Jonah, J-O-N-A-H. Also, even if you've used SeatGeek before, how about this? If you're an MLB fan, you want to go to an MLB game, you can get $10 off of MLB tickets. You use the promo code Carey, K-E-R-I. That's promo code Carey for $10 off of MLB tickets. Or just go ahead and use the promo code Jonah for $20 off of any first-time purchase. That's all you got to do to enjoy the best discounted rates to any ballgame you could possibly imagine. Thank you to SeatGeek for sponsoring the podcast. Some quick programming notes. CBS Sports. Go to CBSSports.com, and at the bottom of the page, you'll find CBS Sports HQ, and you can watch live at any time. I do a trillion billion hits a day for them, talking baseball in all forms. You can also check it out on the CBS Sports app through your Apple TV or Roku or anything like that. It's great. And if you're into basketball or football, hockey, what have you, there is analysis and news all day, all night. You can check all of that out. And I'm, like I said, doing a lot of heavy lifting on the baseball side. Some writing as well for CBSSports.com and also Sportsnet.ca. You could check out my thoughts on the Blue Jays and some other ball clubs. And also, if you are in Canada, check me out on Sportsnet TV every single week. And hey, you know what? Father's Day is this weekend. And you know what you should get if you are trying to get a Father's Day gift? Of course, you should get one of the books that I've written. Check out The Extra 2% if you'd like. That's about the Tampa Bay Rays, sort of Moneyball-ish. If you've never read that, that's fun. And also, my pride and joy, Up, Up, and Away, a book about the late, great Montreal Expos, the entire history of the franchise, interviews with everybody you can possibly imagine. 2-3% memoir, a little bit of that in there, and a lot of fun. I think you'll dig that book too. So check those out. If you can find an indie bookstore, buy them there. Otherwise, check them out online. And that's all you got to do. So yeah, for Father's Day, that'll be fun. And also fun is this edition of the Jonah Carey Podcast. It is with Eduardo Perez. Enjoy. All right, so it's a pleasure to welcome in a friend, former colleague at ESPN. It's Eduardo Perez. Eddie, how are you?
What's going on, Jonah?
It is a pleasure to talk to you. You're one of my favorite people in the industry. Thoughtful. You once took me to Mongolian barbecue when I had no idea what to eat in Greater Bristol, so I appreciate that. I think probably the one decent restaurant within reach of ESPN campus. So I'll be eternally grateful for that.
I appreciate it. But if Mongolian barbecue gets us together, then I'm even more appreciative of the Mongolian barbecue then.
Oh, you're kind. You're too kind. Lots of stuff to talk about. I think what I want to do first, because I like to go back with people. I had Doug Glanville on recently, so we'll go about the same tack. And it's a little bit of a different origin story for Doug than it is for you. Doug did not have family ties necessarily in the game. He sort of chose to play baseball on his own and all that. What is it like when you're a kid and your dad is a future Hall of Famer? Is it just, well, you're definitely going to be a baseball player, or could you have been an orthodontist just as easily? Where did you feel a push, either conscious or unconscious, to pursue this as a career?
No, really, I didn't. That's the crazy part about it. As successful as my dad was and still has an impact in the game, he never forced my older brother Victor or myself to play the game. So all he wanted us to do was do the things that he could not have done when he was younger, and why he worked so hard at this craft of baseball. And it was to give us an education, to be able to, for us to give us the, you could say the tools of being able to speak both languages, both Spanish and English, yeah, fluently. So we won't have any hurdles that he did when he spoke the language, when he had to learn the language of English, which still, as to this day, has given him some trouble, but he's always confronted it. But he was always great. I played more basketball than I did baseball.
Huh.
I played baseball during the summer at the ballpark when I would go and hang out with my brother and all the kids at Riverfront Stadium. We'd grab a bat and a ball. We'd just be kids. But he never forced it upon us. It was never expected that my brother or I would take the reins and be, if it's the next Tony Perez or not. And the most important thing for him and my mom was they made sure that we got an education out of all of this.
When did you first start to realize that you might be really good? You know, that aside from genes, that aside from you're a big guy, certainly, that, oh, okay, it's not just that I'm playing on the high school team or what have you. It's that, no, I actually could make a career of this.
My junior year in college,
okay,
at Florida State, as crazy as it sounds, you got to understand, I never did any travel team like all the kids do where they go on these travel league teams and they play all summer and they play a total of 30, 40, 50. I don't even know what that is. That's very foreign to me. Hmm. What I used to do is during the summers, I used to go where my parents were. My mom would always be with my dad. I would be with, at the time, my grandfather, rest in peace, or my great aunt in Puerto Rico until school ended. I played a lot of basketball, as I said. I played a lot of tennis. And the curious thing was, and the way I started playing baseball consistently was actually in Puerto Rico. Before I get to that final, the answer is my junior year in college. But how did I get there?
Right.
Is actually pretty interesting because one day there was an issue with the basketball court at our school, and we had our practice was canceled, and I was bored, and I said, I'm going to go to the batting cages. This was the beginning of my senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the batting cages, and I'm hitting the baseballs. I'm putting the tokens into the cage, and this kid comes up to me and says, so what team do you play for? And I said, I don't play for a team. And he goes, come on, with that swing, you don't play on a team? I said,
wow.
No, I just do this for fun. And the kid's name was just Vala Cervelo, like I remember to this day. And he told me, he goes, well, why don't you play for our team? And I said, when do you play? It's important to know when did you play, because I really love basketball.
Right.
And he said, no, I play. We practice on Thursdays. We play on Saturdays. And I said, I can do that. That doesn't interrupt at all with my basketball. So they practice on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock, and from there the game's on Saturdays, and I could do that, something fun to do on the weekends. So something to get me out from being at the house all day. And I went to the practice, no problem. I started playing the games, and I did really well. And I was like, wow, you know, these kids play all the time, and I'm hanging out. But then again, it's second nature to me because I do this during the summer a lot, wherever my dad was, if it's in Cincinnati or wherever he was at the time. So there I get seen by another team where the famous Luis Rosas, which was the same guy that signed, his first signee was Ozzie Guillen from Venezuela. But after that, You name any Puerto Rican that played in San Diego, from the Alomars to the Baergas to the Ray Sanchez's, then you go to Texas and you get and then he went to Texas, and that's where he signed Ruben Sierra, Juan Gonzalez. You keep going down the list. And then he went to San Francisco after that. But he had a team, and he called me, and he said, I want you to play for our team. And he goes, if you play for our team, most likely I'll get you to sign. And I said, I just need to go to college. If you can get me to go to college, my parents don't have to pay for it, or don't have to pay for the full part of it, because I saw what the sacrifice that they always had to do with my brother.
Yeah.
Then I'm in. And he said, yeah, come play for me. And I went over. Went to the games. My teammate was Tej Rodriguez was the catcher. He was younger than I was, and they put me to play third base, and he threw a ball to third base that almost broke my thumb, and I said, I'm going back to the outfield, guys. So I went back to the outfield, and all of a sudden, I get a call from Florida State University out of the blue, and it was because of the recommendation that Luis Rosas had given. Had given Rod Delmonico from Florida State. And because of that recommendation, Rod Delmonico trusted Luis Rosa's instincts, his eyes, and he understood what pedigree was about. And this is what Rod Delmonico told me. And he invited me to come up to Florida State. I didn't know where Florida State was in Florida. I had no idea it was in Tallahassee. I didn't know where that was. There was no Google at the time, Jonah.
Uh-huh.
It was crazy. And I go from San Juan to Atlanta to Tallahassee. Guy Gallagher, which is now the clubhouse man for many years for the Tampa Bay Rays visiting side, was waiting for me out right there leaving the tarmac, when I was leaving the tarmac. And he looked at me up and down, and he goes, okay, follow me. And I guess he looked at me because I was 100, at that time, probably 155 pounds soaking wet.
Oh, my God.
I was 6'3".
I cannot picture that.
Well, I played a lot of basketball. I was dead.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and he goes, oh, we got a lot of work to do. And I saw the campus. It was the only school that ever recruited me to play baseball.
Wow.
I had a lot of small college offers to play basketball, but to play baseball, it was the only school. And I was like, listen, if you guys are going to help me pay for my education and I can take a little bit of the burden away from my parents, I'm in. I fell in love with Florida State. Those first 2 years, going into my junior year, I wasn't even a top 100 prospect in college. And all of a sudden, I grew into my body.
Yeah.
And I ended up my junior year at 215 pounds, and I was a different player, a lot more confidence. And the next thing you know, I go 17th pick in the country, first-round pick, 17th pick to the California Angels. But midway through that junior year is when I was like, wow, this is – I can do something with this sport.
I love, by the way, just as a segue, you have a little bit of a zealot aspect to you because of the playing with Pudge early on. And of course, in those Reds clubhouses, I don't even know if you'd remember this if you were old enough, but you know, running around with, I assume Junior Griffey was there because you guys are exactly the same age, and all the were there other kids? Was it just like a cornucopia of like, 6-year-olds running around the big Red Machine clubhouse at that time? Because that had to be the most fun thing ever.
Absolutely. It really was. You know what? I go back to that time, and it was Riverfront Stadium before they changed the name to Synergy Field.
Yeah.
I'll still call it Riverfront Stadium. And even though it's torn down now, that was our home away from home during the summers. And we could not wait, all of us. We knew what was important back then as a 6-year-old. And the things that were important to us is make sure mom gets to the ballpark early, because at that time we still couldn't go with dad.
Yes.
Sometimes we could. And we would go try to steal gum from Bernie Stowe's, from all the gum that he had stored away in the storage. We'd have Ken Griffey Jr. We'd have Pete Rose Jr.
Oh wow.
We had my older brother Victor. We had Craig Griffey. We had there were some kids that would come in one year. They'd be there one year. They wouldn't be there another year. I mean, you name it. We had the McRae was there for a while.
Oh wow.
He was a little bit older. Uh-huh. And he got then he moved on to Kansas City. You can keep going on and on with names. And the beautiful part about it is we played our games. We played them in the tunnels of Riverfront Stadium. And the tunnels were a lot wider. You could have cars go through the tunnel. And now it's a lot narrower in new stadiums. So we already knew if you hit the wall, a certain wall, it was a double. If you hit the railing,
amazing.
It would have been an out. We had all these rules at Riverfront Stadium. And we played all the way to the first pitch of the game. And then at the first pitch, we were mandated by Sparky Anderson that we had to sit and watch the game. And if we saw one of the umpires did anything wrong behind the plate, we had to yell at him, "Umpire, you need glasses." and that so was cute. That was our thing. And we looked forward to it day in and day out. And we had to cheer on the Reds. And if we did not, it was like we held each other accountable. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. I remember Sparky Anderson called us all into the room, into his office one time, and he had a meeting with the kids. And he goes, "Boys, this is what's going on. If the Reds win, you're allowed in the clubhouse before the media can come in.
All right.
If the Reds lose, you're not allowed in the clubhouse." We were fortunate. In the 70s, the Reds didn't lose.
They didn't lose much.
So we were in the clubhouse a lot. and that's what really was so cool, because deep down inside, we were forced to watch the games when we were young. So we knew the game. Our instincts were great. We could see things before they even happened. Just by learning it, by watching it, by studying it. And then we understood the value of winning, of what it took to move the runner over. At the age of five, at the age of six, I knew if there was a runner at second, you have to do everything in your power, not to just hit a ground ball the other way, but to trade places with that guy at second base, hitting the ball with authority the other way. And if it wasn't done, we'd be like, why wasn't it done? And each one of those Reds players, they held each other accountable. So we as kids, we emulated what our parents did, what our fathers did.
Hmm.
We wanted, and we held each other accountable also on our little, I don't want to say it was a little, you know, backyard, but it was our tunnel. Our tunnel was where we made our lick when we were kids at the age of 5, 6, 7 years of age.
That's fantastic. I want to jump ahead to the minor leagues here, and this is kind of a pet project of mine, so I'm curious to get your thoughts. You spent about 2 years in the minor leagues. 91 is when you started, 93 is when you made your big league debut, and we'll get to the big league debut in a second. But I'm always curious about life in the minors, and in your case, you know, as a first-round pick, you would have had a pretty good size of signing bonus. It's not as big a deal, but I'm of the belief that minor leaguers need to be compensated differently. The teams view minor league players is an unlimited resource, and so you can pay guys way less than minimum wage and stack them 6 to a 2-bedroom apartment and, you know, wherever, your Great Falls, Montana, whatever it is, and no problem. And you can argue both sides of it, right? That if so many kids really want to play baseball, okay, it's a supply and demand issue or whatever, but I feel like paying people, I don't care who it is, whether it's a 19-year-old kid or whether it's a 40-year-old person, sub-minimum wage and making them really struggle for it, I'm not sure that it makes this whole idea of toughness and you go through the crucible and this, that. I'm kind of skeptical about this. I think that you can make passable wages and still be tough and still, you know, move ahead and potentially make the big leagues or at least be a good minor league player. Where do you fall on all that? Because it is a contentious issue in baseball. There's a lawsuit potentially pending, and MLB's kind of ignored this.
Yeah, it's tough. It really is. It's the way that minor leaguers, with how they get compensated. I remember my first check, and I'm not talking signing bonus. I remember an A-ball.
Yes.
We were making $750 a month.
Wow.
So we're looking at our checks after taxes, playing in California. I want to say we're coming in around $213.
Oh my God.
Give or take a little bit. And you're like, how did it? And I was just thinking, how do my teammates do this?
Because
my signing bonus helped me.
Yeah.
And it really did. And I was that guy because I was the Latin guy that, that I felt a responsibility because of the way I was brought up, because of what I saw from my father, taking care of the young rookies and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I took it upon myself. I remember when we were in spring training where they put us up in a hotel in Arizona. At that time, we're not getting paid. During spring training, you don't get paid.
Mm.
And what they decided to do was they didn't give us meal money either. They said, we'll feed you at the Sheraton. I remember this.
Yeah.
We'll give you breakfast there. You'll eat a snack at the ballpark, at the clubhouse, which at that time consisted of an apple, a banana, and some Campbell's soup.
Okay.
I remember this clearly.
Uh-huh.
And then at dinner, the dinner was at 7 o'clock. And sometimes it was those dumplings, chicken and dumplings and plates and dishes that none of these Latino kids had ever seen in their lives.
Wow.
So all of a sudden they see they see some greens and dumplings.
Hmm.
Or they see, and it's just, there you go. That's what you have. And the next day, let's do it all over again. And they're not receiving any money. And I was baffled because we would end up our practices maybe at 3 o'clock. And I'm going, they're starving. I'm starving.
Hmm.
And they have to wait till 7 o'clock now for dinner. And you have 1 hour to eat. To me, it just made no sense. So every day, I'm talking every day, and the people at Burger King knew me well. I would go up, and I went there, and I said, "From now on, every day, you're gonna have 99. You're gonna have 99-cent Whoppers. I bought 99-cent Whoppers for, I want to say, the entire spring training for these kids, and it was like 50 Whoppers a day." And it is what it is.
But, yeah.
You know, I felt bad, and these kids when they first saw it, and I'm talking about A ball players, double A players, rookie ball players, just taking care of them. And this was only Latinos. This was also, American kids, whoever needed and wanted food, I felt a responsibility for.
Hmm.
And again, it's a hard living. It's not easy. Those checks don't go far. You have to live your right 3, 4 at a time.
Yep.
It bonds you. It makes you a better teammate. My teammates were Mike Butcher, which is a pitching coach now.
Sure, I know Mike.
For the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Mm-hmm.
This was my AAA teammates. I had Brian Graybeck,
mm-hmm.
Craig Graybeck's younger brother, and I had Garrett Anderson
mm-hmm.
as my roommates in Vancouver. And because it was so expensive in Vancouver, even in AAA, you had the room together.
Yeah,
you couldn't live on your own.
No,
so but you learn and you create unbelievable friendships, bonds from it. But you're right. As far as making a living at the minor league level, at the lower levels, A ball, double A, it's hard to do. It really is, and maybe something will come about it. But you're looking at a 5-month job. The other 7 months, you're going to have to fend for yourself.
Yeah, not easy. No question about it. I want to ask you about your big league debut because, other guys, they talk about, I went 0-for-4, but at least I made a presence felt or whatever. You raked. You instantly came into the big leagues and demolished the Oakland Athletics.
It was so easy.
You were destined for greatness. So tell me, were you nervous? Did you just know that you were going to hammer them that day? Because, you just went to town that day.
It was so easy that it became really difficult afterwards. I'll be straight up with you. I had my brother and I since we were little, and when we played in those tunnels, when we played in Puerto Rico, anywhere we were, Montreal, we lived there also for 3 years.
Hmm.
I went to LCC, Lower Canada College.
Amazing,
also.
You went to LCC. So did my fiance. Fantastic.
How about that? Huh?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So it's a small world, you see?
Yeah.
Beautiful. And we made an agreement, and we always, we played all these creative games, card games and everything. My brother one time said, he goes, "Hey Ed, whoever makes it when you or I make it to the big leagues, we have to, no matter where it is, swing at the first pitch of your first at bat." And I'm like, deal. And this is like a pinky promise that we did when we were like 5, 6 years old. Right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, I get called up to the big leagues and worked my way from Scottsdale, where I got called up.
Yep.
And to we were playing the Scorpions at the time there and the AAA affiliate for the San Francisco Giants. Mm-hmm. And get called up. And my brother, I call my brother, and he goes, "Don't forget our promise." And I go, "Oh my gosh." So there I go, up to the plate, and I don't feel my toes. My heart's beating so fast. And I just couldn't believe that I'm standing in this box right here at the big leagues. And at the time, the big A was enclosed.
Yeah.
And I'm going, wow, it looks so clear. Joe Baber's on the mound, and he throws this slider down and away. Better, more away than down, but it was like in the other batter's box. And I swung, and boom, and everybody's like, ooh. And I was like, okay, promise out of the way. You know, it actually helped me. And then I guess Baber was thinking, this guy's going to swing at everything. I'm going to throw three more there. Not only did he throw three, threw four more there, and I ended up walking on my first at bat. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, all right, this is pretty cool. I got to walk. My on base percentage is up. Well, the second time up, I hit a double down the line in right field.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, this is pretty good. And, you know, it was awesome. You know, they throw the baseball out. They do the whole joke, the whole thing.
Yep.
And then my third time, I want to say my fourth time up in that game,
mm-hmm.
Kevin Campbell is on the mound. And Kevin Campbell was, I had faced him. Earlier on in the year, I faced him in the minor leagues,
mm-hmm.
and he threw me some curveballs that I could not hit. I was like, wow, this guy's got a good curveball.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat curveball. My first big league day, I said, I'm going to sit curveball. I'm going to trust my gut here because I know that he got me out on this pitch, and he hung a curveball, and I hit it really well.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really well, and I knew it was gone, and I sort of flipped the bat. And towards the A's dugout.
Oh!
And Tony La Russa was the manager for the Oakland Athletics.
Yeah.
I round the bases, do the whole thing, come in. I was like, this league is easy, great. That was my last at bat. It was like a 3-run homer, I believe.
Yeah, it was.
And I drive in, Chili Davis and Tim Salmon.
Pretty good.
And all of a sudden, the next day, Ruben Sierra was as calm as he was, as cool as he was. He came up to me and goes, "Hey, man, good home run." I said, "Thanks, man." He goes, "Next time, don't throw the bat. You only got four outs in the big league. Tony La Russa wanted to throw one at your ribs, and I told him I'll talk to you. So I'm talking to you right now. So you don't throw the bat again, okay?" And I said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir." So that was that conversation with Ruben Sierra and myself after my first day in the big league. But it was a surreal experience. It was really, really cool.
Tim Salmon, Chili Day, that's pretty good. That's two of the better players of that era. That's pretty fun. So, gosh, there's so many things I want to ask about a career. One of the things that I'm interested in is that you had success against Randy Johnson, which is insane. Now, you're a right-handed batter, so at least that's a little bit easier. You can remember, everybody remembers, you know, Kroc turning his helmet around and Larry Walker couldn't hit. These great left-handed hitters just felt like they had no chance. Fastball slider. Yeah, you're a righty, but okay, platoon splits only go so far. This is either the best left-hander of all time or second best, depending on how you feel about Lefty Grove. And you hit him. You did pretty well against him. How did that come about? Was it just one of those things? You get up, you know, X number of times you happen to have success, or did you feel like you had his number? Did you feel like you could read the slider? Because that's an incredible feat, you know, incredible for any. I don't care if you're a Hall of Fame hitter, to hit Randy Johnson is something else.
Yeah, it was four home runs total against Randy.
Yeah.
I'm gonna start backwards on this one, and the reason I say this is because I met up last year with Randy in Cooperstown,
yep.
And we're at the Autosaga Hotel in Cooperstown, and he's there with his son, with his son at the bar, at the restaurant bar, and he sees me and he points at me, and I'm like, this isn't good, and he comes over, the unbelievable person, And he's telling his son, he goes, this guy just absolutely mashed against me. And I'm like, okay, I'm in Cooperstown where all the legends are staying in this hotel. And a legend is saying to his son that this guy mashed.
Yeah.
A guy that has 79 career home runs that you're speaking to right now. Well, four of those, thanks to Randy. And he goes, okay, what you got? And I said, Randy, you told me every pitch you were throwing. And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, you tipped every pitch.
Oh!
So, and he goes, I'm telling you now because I'm not going to face you ever again. So I feel a responsibility now to let the cat out of the bag.
Mm.
And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, you did this on the fastball and you did this on the slider. I said, but let's get something straight. You were still nasty as heck to hit because the ball comes screaming out of your hand. It comes whistling out of your hand. I don't know where it's going to go. It's 99. It's 97. It can be 100. And you're so close to me that I can smell your breath. I know you have Tic Tacs or not. And the thing is, now I have to guess location. Mm. But at least I don't have to guess if it's going to be a slider or a fastball.
Right.
And he's like, are you kidding me? And I go, yeah. And so the next day was, and the next day he and Ryan Sandberg were going to clinic and they were in full uniform.
Hmm.
And they were in full uni. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
And to watch him come into the outside of the hotel, and I go, Randy, come over here real quick. And I go, and he has a glove in his hand and he has a ball in his hand. And I go, give me the fastball. And I take a picture of a selfie with the fastball. And I go, give me the slider. And then I show him the picture, and he goes, oh, my goodness. You're a Hall of Famer. And he goes, just imagine if you wouldn't have tipped your pitcher. And I said, you'd have all the records that there could be. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, do you think I'm the only one that knew? I said, that's how nasty you are, that you were telling us what you were throwing. And we still couldn't hit it consistently.
Wow.
And Randy Johnson is one of an unbelievable person, great talent when it comes to photography and everything. But his focus was so much on being able to throw the pitch through the strike zone, because remember when he was in Montreal, he struggled with his location.
Couldn't throw strikes. That
he had to be mechanically sound because as tall as he is, he had to have everything working with him. He had the back issues also. Mm. So all those things, the last thing he was going to think about was his glove. And I was fortunate, and I needed to know, Jonah. I needed to know because going back to A-ball in Palm Springs, I lost my eyesight on my left eye, running the ball into my eye, and I was never the same.
Wow.
So I really only hit in the big leagues with one eye. So I needed to know what was coming.
Crazy. Huh. I want to jump ahead a little bit and talk about post-career. And, I mean, the first time you did TV stuff, this is back in 06, so you've been at this for a little while. And it's a fun gig. You know, you get to really learn a different perspective on the game and all that. Did you envision that right away? Because you pretty much went right from the ball field, more or less, to being on the microphone in one form or another, whether it was in studio for Baseball Tonight or doing game coverage at college initially and then eventually MLB. Was that your thought all along? Was, okay, whenever it is that I hang them up, this is what I'm going to do? Because it feels like it's just a perfect fit. Like, not only, you know, your knowledge of the game and the way you call it, but just your ability to build rapport. And, like, I spoke to Eddie Rosario before the game. He said this. You just have this way about you that lends itself to this gig. So how did this come about? Was it just instant, okay, I'm definitely going to do this? Or was it a happenstance sort of thing?
It sort of happened. I think I was really intrigued by it at some parts. Sometimes I used to think, okay, what am I going to do once I finish playing? Do I want to coach? Do I want to just go into the private business world? Do I want to be an agent? Do I want to do television, radio? And in 2006, when I was with the Cleveland Indians in spring training, the SID director, Bart Swain, had us do a reading for the stadium to be played in Cleveland.
Oh, wow.
And guys were struggling with the reading. And I just knocked it out. I was like, what's so difficult about this? This is what you have to do, and you have to be able to demonstrate and be a little and have a little personality in front of the camera. And because I loved watching all the analysts of not only baseball, but football and basketball, and see who's good, who's not, what do they do. And Bart Swain asked me, he goes, hey, after the season, if by any chance we're not in the postseason, would you be interested in, is it okay if I give your name out so they can use you for postseason, if it's ESPN or whomever was interested? At the time, it was Baseball Tonight was the main thing when it came to baseball. There was no MLB Network. There was nothing really else. I had no Fox baseball. So I was like, sure, that'd be great. And then I get traded for Asdrubal Cabrera from Seattle, from Cleveland to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought out of sight, out of mind. And out of the blue, Bart Swain called me. He goes, you still interested? And I said, absolutely. So then I get a call from Jay Levy from ESPN. And he tells me, he goes, hey, listen, you were highly recommended. Would you mind coming in to do a little postseason? It'll be you, Vernon Wells, and a couple other guys. And I said, no problem. And they said, how much will it be for you? And I said, listen, just put me up at a hotel, get me my plane right, and I'll be happy to do it.
Wow.
I said, I just want an opportunity because you never know. I'm still not retired. And I went. I loved it from day one. I thought it was really cool to be around what I thought were so many knowledgeable people. At the time, Jeff Brantley was there. You had Tim Kurkjian was there. You know, Carl Ravitch, which we always saw on a daily basis. Sure. He was the face of baseball when it came to Baseball Tonight. And John Kruk. And Krucky came up to me and goes, you could do this for a long time. You know that, right?
Mm.
And it just made me think. And those 3 days that I was there, I fell in love with the TV aspect of and working and being able to be productive in something else besides just hitting a baseball. And I went to spring training with the White Sox, didn't make the team. And when I did not make the team, I ended up having a little scope on my knee. And ESPN called me and said, are you going to hang them up? If you are, we're interested in having you work for us. And I said, let's do it. I didn't want to sit around. I didn't want to be out of sight, out of mind. And I have a passion for this. I owe a lot to this game. This game is the reason why my parents met, as my father went to play in Puerto Rico and met my mom there. Both were exiled from Cuba at the time. This is the reason why I'm able to feed my kids. This is, baseball is everything to my family, and I understand it, and I respect the game so much, and having the ability of and being blessed, better said, to be around greatness, including my father, which is a Hall of Famer, mm-hmm. and I was around greatness yesterday with Hank Aaron, and you know, all those stories in the TV booth, all those stories that you could hear, my godfather is Orlando Cepeda, I get them from Jeez. Every corner. I talk to the past. I talk to the present players. The beauty about this game is no one knows everything, and you see something new every day, something you have never seen before. And at all levels, it's not just at the major league level, the little league level, at the college level. And I love being involved in all of it because the game is managed differently now at different levels, but it's still the same pure game that we've all fallen in love with.
It's interesting you mentioned the game being managed differently. Two of our ex-colleagues are managing the Yankees and the Red Sox now. That's a thing. That just happened. So that's incredible. We're sitting in the green room, whatever, eating candy bars at 1 a.m. And now, okay, cool. They're going to maybe manage against each other for the LCS, which is bonkers. What is it about that place? And Baseball Tonight, you know, has it's diminished in frequency. It's not what it once was through nobody's fault, really. It's just changing landscape of baseball. You mentioned MLB Network, things have happened. But what is it about that place, aside from Booney and Cora obviously being super smart and personable and all that, that lends itself to that kind of transition? Because it's a pretty cool thing to think, okay, well, there are these people saying smart things on TV, and now they get to manage, you know, maybe for the World Series. And you yourself have managerial experience and so forth, coaching, who knows what the future holds. But it's a pretty cool thing when that happened. I was like, all right, like, I could see that. And I guess there's a little bit of an incubator there. If you play a successful major league career, then you further hone your skills, really analyzing from the outside. And then I guess it lends itself to maybe going back to the major league clubhouse.
I think it's important, and it's a different perspective that you get watching the game and respecting the game. And again, Boone's a third generation major leaguer. Yeah. Alex is, his brother played the major leagues before he had even signed professionally while he was in the Puerto Rico. Then he went to college at University of Miami. Both went to big time collegiate programs. One went to USC. The other one went to University of Miami.
Yeah.
And not only that, again, when you're around the game and you're around the players, you learn that aspect of it. You see the game as a player. Mm. But when you go into Bristol and you're now picking each other's brains,
yeah,
and you're picking if it's Rick Sutcliffe's brain, or you're picking Buck Showalter, which I think was a huge influence on me because I used to do a lot of Baseball Tonight shows with him for a few years. And then you also have the luxury at ESPN to pick other successful coaches, that have nothing to do with baseball. It could be college basketball.
Yeah.
It could be you know, NFL. You name it. It could be collegiate football. And all the other sports are all there. They're in the green room. They're walking through the hallways. They're in the makeup room. Mm-hmm. You're picking up tendencies. You're picking up communication skills that each one has, and you have the ability to have them in a place that you can gain their trust, and then they can help you also harness that ability of then you going in and being a leader of them. And I think this is what's helped Aaron. This is what's helped Alex. This is what's helped so many others that have gone through those hallways and those rooms in Bristol. And now you're seeing it at a higher level. I mean, it's national television. Anything you say, anytime when you say it live, it's going to be on the air forever. It's going to be found somewhere. It's going to be on YouTube. So you have to be careful, but at the same time, you have to be very original and you have to be credible. And I think Aaron and Alex, when you talk to them, and when you talk to any of us that work in this environment, including yourself, you see the genuineness of them, and those players will run through a wall for them. And I talked to Brett Gardner about it. Brett Gardner came up to me and goes, "Hey man, I did not realize this was in spring training. I did not realize Aaron was this good, and they haven't even started the season." And he was just saying since the first meeting, the way he came about, it's just who he is.
Yeah.
It's who Aaron is, and Alex the same way. And again, I put a uniform on you, and you have great communication skills. You didn't play at the major league level, but you understand the game, and you know the game. And that's all those guys want. They want leadership, and they want to be treated like that.
To your point, by the way, one of the first times, there's a couple of hotels. There's the Homewood Suites there, and there's the DoubleTree. And one of the first times I stayed at the DoubleTree, I went downstairs, it was 9 or 10 in the morning, I was bleary-eyed, I think I'd done maybe a 2 a.m. show the night before, whatever it was. I think it was one of the first times I'd ever stayed there. And I go down, I'm going to get some breakfast, and I'm like, you know, not showered, I'm wearing shorts, I look like hell, whatever. And I go mosey in, and the first person that I see in the restaurant is Mike Ditka. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is what this life is going to be like. That it's going to be, you know, late nights and this, that, and the other. But also Mike Ditka's there when you get – so it was like it was that kind of experience. And it's just a surreal kind of thing to be – as you mentioned, picking the brain of other coaches. It's just like, oh, yeah, Ditka's there. Bobby Knight is there. Like it's a whole different universe.
Bobby Knight, you name it.
Unbelievable. Right. Really interesting. I want to ask you about your ties to Puerto Rico because they run so deep. Obviously, you know from your dad's origins to high school through your post-career, starting the winter training program, managing in winter league, just all kinds of stuff. How much does it mean to you to have baseball continue to be vibrant and maybe even thrive even more? As great as the legacy of the island is, you seem so committed to even growing it even more. I mentioned Rosario the other day, just earlier. I remember the first time you mentioned him on air. I was doing a show with him, and you're like, "My man Eddie, he's hitting," and you could just see the pride that you have for PR and for guys who come out of there. So, how important is it for you to see baseball thrive there, and what are you trying to do to try to make that happen?
That's a great question, and I think the same pride that I am watching every Puerto Rican play, hit, pitch at the major league level.
Yeah.
I believe you have the same pride every time you see a Canadian step up to the plate.
Yeah, I guess so.
And in the major leagues, I mean, you mentioned Larry Walker earlier on in this in this interview. So it just goes a long way. Again, both my parents are Cuban. They met in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
They married in Puerto Rico. I was raised in Puerto Rico. I would have been born there, but I was an in-season child, and so was my brother. So during the season, we were in Cincinnati. I was born in Cincinnati and proud of it. But I consider myself a Puerto Rican.
Hmm.
And my kids were born there. My wife's from there. I still have a home there. To me, just like baseball, I owe everything to that island. And I owe everything to the people there. And as soon as I retired and I hung them up, I needed to do something to help out the development of Puerto Rican players once they signed. Because the problem there is in Puerto Rico, and it started when the draft came to Puerto Rico in the early 1990s. It came to Puerto Rico, and once it did, people did not know what to do. The whole entire infrastructure of having scouts develop their players before they signed, practice them, take them, spend months with them, and then say, okay, you're ready to go and sign, and they give them a bonus for that as a free agent signee, that was all long gone. So now these young players were left with no high school team because not a lot of high school, you don't play high school baseball over there. It's American Legion. It's Connie Mack. You're responsible for yourself. You're not responsible. No one else is responsible for you. There was nobody picking you up, nobody teaching you the way. And then you get drafted, and then you go on your lonesome self to a spring training site either in Arizona or Florida. And then when you come back to Puerto Rico, you have nowhere to practice because that American Legion team, they're doing something else. There's no high school team. You don't know how to work out. You don't know how to practice during the off season, and your talent level stays the same.
Yeah,
there's winter baseball, but the problem is when you're an A-ball, you're usually not playing. You usually don't belong to a team. You're not on the active roster. They don't want you around, and there's nothing to do.
Hmm.
What do? Where do you work out? And I felt there was a void. And I went back to Puerto Rico, and I developed this program called the Winter Training Program, WPP. And I asked my wife, she's a lawyer, I said, can you help me out write this? She goes, you write it, I'll iron it out for you.
Hmm.
And then I had to, that's exactly what we did. And then we both got on a plane, and we went to New York, and we knocked on the door of the Players Association where Gene Orza was there. And I explained the program to Gene Orza, because that year there was no winter ball in Puerto Rico. So what were the players going to do that year without any winter ball at all? And the young players with nobody else to work out with. Hey, you got to buy balls. You got to do the bats, the whole thing. And then from there, we went to Jimmy Lee Solomon, at the time was in charge of international side of Major League Baseball. And I showed him our proposal. And I said, this is what I want to do to help out the island of Puerto Rico. Because there was a lot of damage done to it with the infrastructure and how to develop players once they signed. And we ended up using the Adolph B. Thorne Stadium where this year the Cleveland Indians and the Minnesota Twins played a series. And we had a total of 125 players show up for 6 weeks. And we worked them out. And I had coaching staff. I had the whole thing.
Hmm.
And we had sponsors. Major League Baseball was a big sponsor. The Player Association was a big sponsor. Marucci's Bat Company at the time, which is now Marucci Sports, was a big sponsor. Each organization, Major League organization, gave us $3,000 and three boxes of minor league baseballs for us to practice. And I wanted minor league baseballs. I did not want big league baseballs. Everything was done with a purpose.
Yeah.
And the reason why I wanted minor league baseballs, because each case in a minor league baseball case comes 10 dozen baseballs. In a big league case, there's 6 dozen baseballs. I needed quantity. I did not need a stamp that said Major League Baseball. I needed the Marucci Bat Company set. I mean, so many bats, 400 bats, different models for players to use. We had coaches. We gave jobs to coaches. We worked our butts off. It was great. and then we pressured the island, pressured the Puerto Rican Baseball League to come back the next season, and they did. And we've now learned, and those young players, they learned how to train on their own. They learned how to train in the offseason. We had Maldonado, which is the catcher for the LA Angels.
Yep.
He was part of the winter training program. He was there as an A-baller when he belonged to the Brewers. Yep. We had a lot of Mets players. We had a lot of Cubs players. Yadier Molina came and worked out. Albert Pujols came and worked out. We had Carlos Delgado at the time. Javier Vasquez at the time. They worked out. Luis Matos, you name it, they were there. J.C. Romero, the big leaguers were coming to work out alongside with minor leaguers, A-ballers. And that's what we needed. We needed to show the owners of the winter ball team that these players want to play. They need somewhere to work out. And it's unfortunate that I could not continue the winter training program, but it was unfortunate because the reason we couldn't is because now all those parts were taken the next year because there was winter baseball again. And that was the purpose of this whole thing. Give these players a place to go play, and they'll show up. And they showed up big time.
That's awesome. I want to ask you where we're at. We're getting on toward a year after Hurricane Maria first touched down. Where are we at on the island? Just devastation, obviously. What can people do? I mean, it's the simplest thing seems to be, write a check to somebody, and that'll be the end of that. What is most needed there at this point? What do we maybe don't know? Just sitting in comfort in the suburbs of wherever North American city that we are, not realizing what the state of the island is. How much better is it, and how much work is left?
Well, you can still tell that it was devastated. I'm not going to lie to you and say it were 100%.
Yeah.
The tourist areas, if you go to Puerto Rico, and that's the thing. We look at what's the most important thing that Puerto Rico needs. It's tourism.
Yeah.
And so don't think because Maria hit that, Puerto Rico was hit hard, so we shouldn't go there. On the contrary, Puerto Rico needs people to go, people to see what happened, people to see the history of Puerto Rico. The old San Juan is beautiful. You need to go into the inside of the island, also to the center of the island, to see still a little bit of devastation, put it in perspective. But most importantly, what Puerto Rico needs is people to continue to talk about it more than anything. Keep it in the forefront. And I think that's the most important thing. And we're all guilty of this. We saw when Irma hit Florida. We saw when Harvey hit Houston. There's people that are still affected by that too. But being in an island all by yourself out there, and it's an island 100 by 30, we cannot forget how important it is. As a matter of fact, while I'm working and I'll be going to the College World Series for the next 2 weeks, my wife and kids, they're going to go down to Puerto Rico for a week because we feel it's important. We feel it's important that they understand, it was hit hard, but we still have to come back and at least help out the economy one way or another. Another thing that's, it's not about the money now. It's, everybody's like, send money to this, send money to that. You know, what is needed? Mattresses were needed big time at the center of the island. Where power went out, where the houses were flooded. And then all of a sudden, the water recedes and there's no power. And there's total darkness. And from that, here you get all the mold. And you get all the stuff that, makes people sick. And so mattresses, simple things that are needed for the daily, just to help out. But right now, I think it's just important to create the awareness and understand that it's hurricane season again. June 1st, hurricane season started again.
Yeah.
It picks up big time between mid-August and September. It's when the Caribbean is at a high of being threatened, just like it is in the panhandle of Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas. All those states, they're vulnerable right now, and it's a tough time and it creates unbelievable awareness when it comes to that. But we just can't forget, from the fires in California to the tornadoes in the valleys, and we all those things, we have to be aware, and we just, again, it's human nature tells us, okay, move on after a little bit, because news happens fast.
Yeah.
But it's one thing to create that awareness.
Eduardo, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. This was a great excuse to catch up. I'm glad to hear things are going well. We'll watch you at the College World Series. That should be really, really exciting. I know that you look forward to that every single year as well, and we will check you out on ESPN. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
John, I appreciate you having me on your show. Thanks a lot.